Hi, this is Dawn Sharon. This is my podcast, Dancing with Bipolar. Well, today I have a very special treat for you in lieu of Mental Health Awareness Month. My friend and colleague, Dustin Bailey, mental health champion for our local Celebrate Recovery and all-around good guy. So let's talk to Dustin today and get some information about what it is to be a bipolar male and also what his role is with Celebrate Recovery. So without further ado, here's Dustin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm super. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Cool. So I kind of gave a brief intro just so they know who I'm talking to. So they're not just like, well, who is she talking to? But I'd like for you to drop a... Anyway, everybody, this is Dustin Bailey. He is the lead dude for Arizona for CR. And we're going to talk more about what CR Celebrate Recovery is and how Dustin's role is imperative to keep CR running. But first of all, why don't you give the posse here just a brief bio about who you are and what it is and why what your mental health is and why it is so important for men to acknowledge the fact that they have a mental health diagnosis.
Absolutely. I'll start with a Celebrate Recovery introduction. We do this with CR as a way of introducing ourselves, and it basically says, I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ. I celebrate recovery every day from codependency, sexual sins, and mostly from the fallout from bipolar disorder. My name is Dustin. I serve in Celebrate Recovery as the regional mental health champion for the Western region of the United States. And I help other churches, other Celebrate Recoveries, and anybody that'll hold still long enough to listen in being established a mental health champion in their Celebrate Recovery in their area. And we'll talk a little bit about what a mental health champion is, but
yeah,
a little bit more about my background. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a loving but strongly dysfunctional family. I think a lot of folks can relate to that. Yeah. My dad was as a tradesman, so he was working in the trades, which meant feast or famine. We had ramen noodles one weekend and steak dinners the next, depending on whether there was work. Mm-hmm. My mom was a volunteer at church, worked multiple jobs to help keep things going, and also was a staying at home, helping raise me and my three brothers, which was like a Herculean task I wouldn't wish on anybody. And so that put her under a lot of stress. So my mom and dad were under a tremendous amount of stress. And that manifested itself into an awful lot of verbal, physical, kind of emotional fights that broke out around the house. And those were the first triggering events that let me know that one or both of my parents had mental health challenges, and my mm-hmm. mom in particular with bipolar disorder. I just didn't know what the name was at the time. Okay. Well, fast forward till I'm 19 years old and I'm in college, and all of a sudden I don't want to go to class anymore, and all I can do is sleep, or at other times all I can do is not sleep, and I stay up all night obsessing about ideas. And that was my first experience bouncing between mania and depression. Mm-hmm. And those first moments of having bipolar disorder, I am a bipolar disorder type 2, which means I don't have a lot of those psychotic events. So I don't have the hallucinations. I experience reality in the same way that the folks around me do, which is a blessing for me. I actually count that as a win. But mm-hmm. it's this process of growing for the next 20 years without a diagnosis. So literally like running raw through nature and running raw through life, banging into everybody around me in states of depression or mania and doing a lot of harm to the people I love, my family, my close friends. It was a real challenge. And then right around 2011, I had a moment where a moment of lucidity and clarity came around, where I started to get very serious about my mental health and started realizing that this is something that I need to look into, and got my diagnosis of bipolar disorder, worked with a counselor to set up some treatment plan, got some good medications that are finally and worked out for me. And anybody that's got bipolar disorder knows how much fun it is to work out the cocktail or the you try a bunch and it works, and sometimes it doesn't, and then you figure it all out. But I've had the opportunity to live with bipolar and live through bipolar disorder for the better part of a decade now, and I've slowly started to realize that in my faith structure, my God makes things fearfully and wonderfully, and he doesn't make mistakes, which means if he made my brain, then I'm designed by God to have bipolar disorder. And It's a bipolar disorder that's designed in me on purpose and for his purpose, which is essentially twofold. Number one, to remind me I can't do this by myself. I need people alongside me. I need to listen to the smarter people with lab coats that say such about medicines and the people that have comfy couches to lay on and talk about what's going on in my life. And then I also, it becomes a touchstone so I can talk to other people that have the same struggle I have and offer them some experience, some strength, and some hope. Because if you've been online, you notice that there's really not a lot of that out there. If you're doing any of your own research in bipolar disorder or mental health challenges in general, you find that it's doom and gloom. It's an idea that basically says, well, you're going to have a lifelong hard life and your family's going to suffer. So good luck with that. And I'm here today to tell you that I don't believe that. I don't believe that the world is doom and gloom. Matter of fact, sometimes bipolar disorder can be a superpower and give me abilities to see and experience the world in a way that's 11 degrees left of skew that other people don't get to see it. And I think that's the fun part is discovering why the blessings and the superpowers of bipolar disorder can outweigh the pains that you go through to experience them. So that's a little bit about me.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. And like my posse, that's what I call my audience. They know that there is no doubt that we all have capes underneath our t-shirts. So that the fact that you said that just means that you are now like an honorary member of the posse. So welcome in.
I'm happy to be. And I imagine it's an awful lot like the mafia that once you're in, you never get out. And I'm glad to stay.
That's right. There's no kick out on this one. So I just wanted to say when you were diagnosed, was that a relief or was that one of those moments? Because like you said, the research on bipolar can be daunting to say the least. Were you like, oh my gosh, finally I have a name for this? And even though, I mean, now the treatments are like, you know, it's like it's really no biggie. The medications aren't as you know, trial and error. Well, you know what I mean? They're not like guinea pigging us on medication now where it's kind of like, well, try this one. And we don't know what the side effects are, but you know, it seems to have worked with this test group. And you said like, at 19, so, you know, that was a little while ago. Were you relieved or were you like flatlined when you heard the diagnosis of bipolar disorder?
I think the short answer is yes.
Okay. That's fair.
I experienced my first real deep dives into bipolar disorder when I was 19, but I didn't get my diagnosis for another 20 years when I was 39. Right. So I had 20 years of just absolute nightmarish kind of a roller coaster ride, of frightening and unstable living. And so when I finally did get a diagnosis, there was an element of, wow, this actually does have a name. I'm not the only person on the planet that's going through this. So, hey, look, I'm not alone, but there also was this, wow, I am hopelessly broken. Yep. It came immediately behind.
Exactly. I do know what you mean. Yeah, exactly. I was, when I got the diagnosis, cause I was the same way. I probably had, I did have a mental health issue probably since the age of about, I don't know, 13 or 14. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was 40. So I went all that time, like just thinking my brain was broken. And as I know from listening to you before, you have an intimidating IQ, which can mask, I think, a lot of mental health issues because you're smart and you figure out ways to work around, you know, what you don't know is wrong. So, I mean, because that's how it worked for me. We're not going to compare IQs because we don't need to, but I too have a very intimidating IQ. And I think in a way it was kind of a double-edged sword, like, because I knew I was super smart, but I also knew my brain was broken, but I wasn't sure if my brain was broken because I was super smart. And that's why I couldn't relate to other people or fit in. So is that what you experienced or was it different for you?
A lot of those experiences were the same. I grew up with being the brainy kid, yep. A lot like you're talking about. And so I had this wide understanding of how the world worked. And I kind of thirsted for that kind of knowledge. It was kind of a way of controlling my environment because if I was smart enough, I maybe see things happening before they came and maybe try to make those adjustments or cope with it. The problem with that is that if you try to do all that stuff by yourself, two things happen. Number one, you're banking on a lucidity of thought that doesn't always exist. So you may be making blind adjustments in your car when the headlights are off and you can't see the road. You've got a pretty good idea where to steer the car, but you're clearly not able to see where you're going. And so what I thought might be great adjustments slammed me straight into walls. So that's the first part of that. The second part was this hopelessly bound construct that because you know something, it doesn't impact you or affect you, or it can be minimized. And what I've come to understand over the course of life is that I have this exceptional depth of knowledge around mental health, around my own mental health conditions. I know all the tools. I've been to counseling forever. I've got all that stuff worked out. I know how to explain it to other people in an easy way. And guess what? It still sucks. I still have to feel it. I still have to go through it. And all that knowledge in the world doesn't mean anything, because ultimately I still have to experience it.
That's true. That's actually, that is true. And I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you, because it's absolutely true.
Oh, I get it.
So this is kind of a double-fold question. So, as a man with a mental health issue, so like, I'm not a man, obviously, but you know, men are not supposed to, in our society, quote unquote, okay, air quotes here, they're not supposed to show weakness, and they're not supposed to be vulnerable, you know, and they're just supposed to, you know, power through it. Now, being a man of God with a mental health issue, does that kind of, I mean, I know you, so, you know, and I don't know your answer, but I know you, so I know that you're a strong dude, and that, like, you know, you are very steadfast in your values. But do other people look at you that may not understand what it means to be a man of God with a mental health issue? Do they look at you as like a target?
I don't know if I necessarily feel like a target. I kind of feel like a narwhal or a unicorn. In the fact that I don't fit very nicely into the construct of where a lot of our society talks about. And I openly embrace that. And because of that, I am unique in my world, especially around a lot of my friends. Now, remember we talked earlier, I was telling you that my dad grew up in the trades as a carpenter and as a contractor. He taught me early on that man up was the way you did it. You take whatever pain and whatnot, and you stuff it down, and you press on. And unless the bone was sticking out, you didn't go to a doctor. And unless shut down, you just didn't get any kind of help. And that's not to knock him. That was his generation's entire mindset and the generation before. And so coming to terms with, there was a level of, I can't get through this. As a man, I felt like I was failing. I felt like, well, everyone else should be doing this, and they are, and I'm not. Even though I've couched that in the construct of being a man, I really feel like every human being experiences that. I think that men or women feel like they see the rest of the world through a wonderful Instagram filter, or through a wonderful Facebook post that says, hey, my life is perfect. And then you feel like, why is my life not perfect? And how incredibly imperfect it is. So as a man, it took a while to come to terms with the fact that the true strength, What strength really is power under control. And so, I mean, a lot of guys have raw power and they go out there and just try to will things to be in existence. But power under control is where real strength, especially what I would consider the manly strength, if there's such a word, comes from, is being able to know that you have the power to do something, but also having restraint to know exactly how much or how little of it to exercise. And then when I started to apply that construct to my own mental health, there was a realization that if I try to power through this, I'm going to hurt myself and everyone around me. But the real strength is realizing that my power won't do it. And power alone is not going to get me there, that I'm going to need something. I'm going to need a source of power that's not only infinite, but also infinitely gentle. And I think that was the first time for myself that the idea of being a man with mental health challenges, man with bipolar disorder, started to shift into the construct of stewardship rather than will, because my willpower won't power anything. It's, you know, it should be called willpower, actually. But the ability to steward my life, which meant I've been given this life that I'm supposed to be taken care of, just like everything else in my world. A biblical viewpoint of manhood is you are given some things that you're responsible for, and you've got to steward them and let them grow and take care of them, because they're not yours. You're tending to them. And if that applies to my children, if that applies to my wife, if that applies to the resources around me, if I can apply it to my tithing, why can't I apply it to my own mental health? And that was the turning point for me. Now I view manhood, biblical manhood, the Christian construct of it, and even the manhood within mental health challenges, as understanding the value of brokenness and weakness as a form of stewardship and submission. I'm reminded of Kitsukuri, which I know that a lot of folks talk about, and it's that the Japanese pottery that's been handed down from generation to generation that has no real monetary value. It has an intrinsic nostalgic value, but no real monetary value. And oftentimes what will happen is, it looked like they happen in my house, someone bumps into the table and off falls the vase, or off falls the teapot, and it breaks. And so what Kitsukuri is the Japanese practice of taking that broken pot and using smelted gold to put all the pieces back together. And the gold itself holds when it cools, where it's not only structurally stable, it's also got a stability for its function. So it holds water, it does all the things it's supposed to. Now here's the key, is it's more beautiful with the gold than it was before it started. It's this eclectically beautiful piece of pottery. And its monetary and tactile value is infinitely higher with that gold. And the key is, it's more valuable because it was broken.
Right.
And I see that in myself, is I find more of my value in my brokenness, because I'm not the one that put my pieces together. It's I've got a God that loves me enough to use his best gold to put me back together in the way he wants me there. And I think that because I'm broken, I'm more valuable to him in his kingdom's work. Maybe not to him, because I have the same value to him no matter what I do or what I don't do.
Right.
But exactly. Within the application of his kingdom and being able, I can serve people. I can be more valuable to others because of my brokenness. Yep. And that's what I believe being a man of God and being a man of God with a mental illness is. I do still face a lot of folks and know a lot of folks. Most of the guys I know don't believe they can show their weakness or their brokenness. They don't see the value in it. Matter of fact, they buy into the cultural message that being a man with mental health challenges, being a man with mental illness or any kind of weakness, is a sign of lesser value. And so most every guy I know feels lonely. Most every guy I know suffers in silence, does the thing that we all do when we have mental health challenges, and that is we suck it up and put all our effort and energy into functioning in the places we have to. Like when I go to work, I've got to strap it all together and plow through it because that's the thing that needs to be done. And by the end of the day, when I come home to my family or to myself, I have no energy left. I've spent every bit of resource I have keeping the facade of functionality moving forward in the face of a bunch of other people who are equally as dysfunctional as I am. And so every man I know experiences that to one degree or another. And the real challenge is helping men see that just like everything else in the Bible that has this dichotomy, you know, people that are blessed are the poor, for they shall be, you know, there's the blessed are the humble, for they should be celebrated. There's, if you go through the Beatitudes, it's here's one thing, they get the opposite. The first shall be last. And so understanding that the concept of being weak, becoming your strength, being able to say, I am weak so that he can be strong, really lets you connect more into what strength, the true source of strength should be, and the true source of that manhood or that manly identity should be, which is entirely in God's power and absolutely not at all in your own.
True. I mean, that's really true for anybody. I mean, it really is. It's like, as soon as you surrender and give up that control or what you think you have control over, things become so much easier because you don't really have to worry about it. I mean, of course you have to, you know, do your daily tasks and all that mundane stuff. But in the bigger picture, it's like, he's got you covered upside down, backwards and forwards. And, you know, and it takes some time to get there, everybody. I'm not saying, you know, it's all going to come like in an instant just because you're like, oh, I surrender everything. And it's not quite that cut and dry, but it kind of is actually.
It's simple, but in no way easy.
Exactly. We'll go with that. Okay. So I'm really, that lonely thing is, it really hit me. That's really interesting. So is that, Is that one of the things that you can recover from in Celebrate Recovery? Would loneliness be, would that be considered, what is it, habit, a hang up habit, or what is it?
It could be a hurt, hang up, or habit. And that can actually be all three.
Yes.
The short answer also is that no matter what you're thinking in your head right now, if you're listening to this or as we're talking, if you can think it, yes, Celebrate Recovery can help you through it. The way that I think about it is if there's anything in the world that's causing you a pain point, or if there's anything in the world that's separating you from an absolutely full life that God has for you, that's a thing you can use the tools of Celebrate Recovery for. Because the whole idea of Celebrate Recovery is to let go of your efforts to control and fix things, which clearly, if they worked, they'd be working, and they're not because you're still feeling it. So finding some other way of doing it becomes necessary. And loneliness is definitely one of those things. I do believe being alone may not be a choice, but being lonely is always a choice.
Right. I agree with that.
It's how you engage and interact with people. And sometimes it's one of the, I don't say that to dismiss it or diminish it in any way. It's profound. It's mm-hmm. very heavy. And it's very hard. The idea of being able to solve your loneliness by simply connecting with someone is the very root of loneliness in the first place.
Right.
So you're trying to swim upstream against the very thing you're trying to swim away from. And so having help, having an environment that that you don't have to conquer loneliness, you just have to conquer the front door and be able to walk into it, and then have people that will come alongside you because that's just what they do. And then help you find those tools and apply those tools. The very nature of just seeking the help by walking in the door automatically gets you 2 to 3 steps closer to addressing the loneliness and moving forward with it. But I also think you've got to find the redefinition of loneliness, and you've got to find that loneliness is an intentional isolation rather than the feeling of lack of companionship. Because companionship can be solved by simply walking into a Walmart and hanging around long enough for even the loss prevention people to walk up and say, "Can I help you?" You know, now you've got a person. There we go. But it's the isolation of just saying to yourself, and it's a matter of how you self-value. Those are things that take time, but Celebrate Recovery can definitely work on them.
I love that. That's so funny, but that is so true. And I mean, especially now that we're kind of coming out of COVID, but the COVID thing, I think I saw some crazy stats when I was researching for another interview about the amount of people that have suffered with a mental health break due to loneliness because of COVID, and the social distancing and everything was an outrageous number, like 200% like increase from like 2019 to 2022 or something like that. And it was just like, I mean, and that's just like a small polling group, you know what I mean? So it's like the number is probably much larger than that. But that's a great way. It's like, guys, if you don't want to be lonely, go find a local CR chapter in your area. And I'll have Dustin explain how you can go about that too, because he's much more versed on that. But I mean, if you walk into that, you're going to be loved on immediately, and you're not going to have a chance to be lonely anymore, because you're going to have people that are going to be all over you in a good way, wanting to help you and wanting you to help yourself. So can you explain more to people like how they can find a local CR, or even what CR is? Because we're talking about it because we know what it is. But some folks listening here, and I have talked about it on prior podcasts, but not in depth, because I wasn't quite as involved in it now as I will be. But you're the man to explain to them who, what, why, where, when, and how about CR.
Absolutely. I mean, so CR is our abbreviation for Celebrate Recovery. It is a Christ-centered 12-step recovery program that will work for any hurt, habit, or hang-up that you have. Now, a hurt is basically exactly what it sounds like. It's something that's causing you a pain point in your life. It's something that someone else could have hurt you, or you might even have hurt yourself physically, emotionally. Examples of that are sensations of abandonment. There's self-worth issues and body image issues. These are some examples of hurts, people that are struggling through homelessness, people that are struggling through broken relationships, people that are struggling through divorce, or even things like grief if you've lost somebody along the way and you're having a hard time moving forward. Those are things that hurt. You didn't necessarily choose them. Some of them were chosen for you, but they're causing you pain points that are getting in the way of moving forward in life. And then you have habits. habits are what they sound like. They're just repeated things. It's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. These are the types of things where you use these habits as coping mechanisms at the start to try to help heal some of those hurts or to patch some of those pains. And what eventually happens is the habit becomes more of a rote function than a salve, and it actually makes the pain worse. Some of the typical responses you might have, I mean, you might think of Celebrate Recovery as a recovery program around substance use or alcohol use, and that is a good tool to use for that. But roughly 2 out of 3 people that attend Celebrate Recovery attend for a reason other than substances. It's actually a good focus of the minority of the folks that attend are there for habits that are around substances. But there are tons of other habits. Shopping is one of those things that I bumped into, especially in COVID. The Amazon guy knows my house by heart. I have Amazonnesia a lot of times, which is that box right. Shows up and you forget what it is. It just says Amazon. When did I buy that? I don't remember. And then you open it and some weird trinket. But that's a thing. There's also people that have habits around other addictive or compulsive behaviors like gambling, sexual integrity issues. But there are also other habits that you can get into, like self-harm, or isolation can be a habit more than a hurt. And then there are hangups. These are things you can't get past or over. I've struggled with them in my life, and other people have as well. A good example of that, going back to grief, maybe you can't get past or over the loss of somebody. Or maybe in a relationship, there was infidelity in the relationship, and you just can't seem to get past either the betrayal that you experienced from your partner, or your partner's partner in the and the kind of maybe rage, or the kind of maybe resentment, or the ill wishes of that person, which is where the focus is, and you get stuck on that. Those are examples of hangups. And so it's kind of progressive. I should probably describe it as a hurt that can become a hangup that eventually leads to a habit. A lot of folks can see that progression, but any one of those can be present in your life. And so what Celebrate Recovery does is it applies the 12-step program, the programs that are out there, and the biblical comparisons that go along with it to show you that the Bible supports it. Or they apply the 8 recovery principles that are found in the Beatitudes that talk about in order how you can. It's amazing. Christ's most famous sermon goes in order in how you can help restore the pains out of your life and get closer to him. And so we use those tools, and it's also support that comes alongside that. There are other people in the room. I always tell people, welcome home. Look to your left, look to your right. It's a person just as messed up as you. So you're in the right space. And it's a place that has no judgment, because everyone is there recognizing that they have a struggle, and everyone is there seeking the same types of tools. So you can go into these groups and share anything and know that you're not only in the safest place possible, but no one's going to judge you for it. In fact, being able to talk about it helps break the control it has and the hold it has over your life. And having a lot of other people that were just nodding their heads in either agreement or in recognition of their own lives and your story helps. And so this is a place that meets one night a week, all over the place. So if you want to find how to find one of these places, you can simply go to celebraterecovery.com, and in the top right hand corner, there'll be a Celebrate Recovery locator. And all you do is type in your zip code, how far you're willing to drive or walk, and you press the button, and it shows you a whole list of which recovery Celebrate Recoveries are in that area, what a telephone number and an email address is for the main point of contact, what night they meet. If they have other areas of recovery, we have Celebration Place, which is recovery for kids, their elementary school. We have The Landing, which is Celebrate Recovery for teens in junior high and high school. We've got a lot of different specific ministries that help recovery for the entire family. So this will tell you where to go, what services are there, and then you can either reach out or just show up. And I would encourage you, just if you're thinking about it, just give it a shot. Go ahead and walk in. And what I will tell you is you will be loved on, but for my introverts out there, you won't be rushed. You won't be
smothered.
What'll happen
is they will let you eat your stew, because that's another thing about it. Like if you just want to go and just like think you're just going to go and eat some food for like, you know, half hour with people, you will stay. But yeah, they won't rush you. It's a gentle love.
People there figured out how to be able to come alongside somebody and not work it for them. One of our principles that we have, one of our guidelines, I should say, is that we're here to support people, but not fix them. So no one's
right
going to judge. Yeah. No one's going to say you should do this, or, you know, I like to say no one's going to should all over you. And they're just going right. to let you be you. And I think, and walk alongside you while you'll get better.
Yeah. It's an amazing group. So, so as far as like our people with mental health diagnoses go, and it's not just for bipolar, for schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, autism, you name it, whatever. I mean, even like, you know, gambling and alcoholism, they do fall under a mental health banner. What is it that you and me in the near future, as champions of our, well, you're the regional champion, but as champions of our, you know, local CR, what exactly is it that we do for members of the posse that come in?
Gotcha. So a mental health champion at a Celebrate Recovery is a person that's on the leadership team there. And their purpose is to make sure they come alongside folks with mental health challenges when those folks are ready to add them as part of their recovery. Folks might have struggles with mental health challenges and just not be at the place where that's the primary issue. Maybe the thing that's really killing them right now is a substance-based thing, or a hurt, mm-hmm. a habit, a hang up other than mental health challenge. And so, like, for example, for me, I was in recovery for 5 years before I added mental health as an active part of my recovery. And so maybe there's some stabilization that has to happen. So don't feel like when you, as a mental health champion, you've got to make sure everybody's connected to mental health resources, because we all need it. Even though technically speaking, the percentage of people that are in recovery rooms have a comorbidity of 50% with people that have addictive or compulsive behaviors. So whether you're coming from a substance area that's changed your brain chemistry, that's created some mental health challenges, or you're coming from mental health challenges that you're trying to self-medicate with addictive or compulsive behaviors, either way, the number is 50%. So even though everybody in that room with you, and there's a higher number or percentage in Celebrate Recoveries, because we're the folks that recognize we need help. So mm-hmm. there's a higher number there. That doesn't mean that this mental health champion is going to make sure every single person is moving forward in a mental health plan. Far from it. Instead, what we do is we simply walk alongside. First thing we do is we start having the conversation. We try to remove or reduce or eliminate ultimately the stigma around mental health in every aspect of where we're at, but especially in Celebrate Recovery. There are people that when you say, hi, how are you? And you talk about schizoaffective, they don't know what to do with that. It's not necessarily that they may or may not feel anything that our society teaches, things like fear or avoidance or a negative connotation behind it. It just may be simply they don't know what to say. So mental health champions start having that conversation in their Celebrate Recoveries, and they normalize it. Let's make it normal to talk about what's going on. I mean, if you ask somebody, hey, how are you doing? And they would say, oh, I found out I have diabetes and I got to work on my blood sugar. Or they say, hey, yeah, I found out that I have cancer, but I'm getting treatment. It's good. We as a society, even though those two things used to be things in the past that we just wouldn't talk about, we couldn't even call it cancer. We called it the C word because we couldn't say cancer.
Exactly. Now, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Every person can talk about it. Yeah. And so we have that conversation. The other thing we do is we provide resources for folks. So we look up mental health providers in the local area, and we kind of steer people when they're ready to add that to the programs. And they say, hey, I want to see a counselor. I don't know how to start. We help them start that process in a way that's appropriate for them. And then we also come alongside and bring some accountability to them when they're ready for it. One of the challenges I had when I first started getting into recovery and getting into recovery for my mental health was getting comfortable and used to and very good at taking my medication. So mm-hmm. I had a friend of mine named Brian, who's a big guy, and I had him swear that he would start every conversation with me for the first 6 months that he had with me with the phrase, have you taken your meds today? So phone would ring, hey, Brian, have you taken your meds today? Yes, I have. Oh, I'm doing great. How are you doing? You know, and that's the conversation. Or ring, hey, Brian, have you taken your meds today? Do I need to come over and help you take your meds?
Exactly. Nope,
I'm taking them right now. You take them? Yeah. Oh, I'm great. How are you doing? So that type of accountability that says I'm going to follow the treatment plans that my professionals have put in place to help me, and I'm going to let other people help walk alongside me to do that. One of the experiences in bipolar disorder is you start to have this selective lucidity, this refilter of reality, where you could swear some stuff has happened, and it clearly hasn't. Yeah. You know, I could swear for multiple times that I'm keeping up on my counseling, and, you know, I just saw my counselor just last week, and my accountability folks would be like, no, it's been 4 months. So you need to follow up like right now. And so having that helps keep us supported. And then mostly having conversations from the front of the room, people sharing their testimonies that have mental health challenges inside of those, maybe having experts come in and talk a little bit about what does it really mean to have depression or anxiety? What does a panic attack look like? What does it look like to have a value in the faith construct of Christianity and dispel the myths that mental health has anything to do with demon possession, that medications are okay to take as a Christian, that you don't experience healing in the way that you might want to pray it away, but rather that healing is not in mental health is not about the absence of symptoms, but rather the presence of contentment to walk alongside Christ through them. So you learn these things. And that's what the mental health champions do. Now, they're at the local Celebrate Recovery level. There's a level above that called the State Mental Health Champion, and their job is just to connect the dots with all the local folks so we can share our resources a little better. And then my job as a regional mental health champion is to help establish some of the directions that we're going in terms of making sure we've got some good tools out there. We've got some good training for folks when they want to learn a little bit more about what to do, and that we can answer questions and provide support to anybody at any one of those levels so that nobody feels like they're out there having to do it like the Lone Ranger by themselves.
Right. Which is great. So, yeah, I'm really honored to have you on the show. Actually, it's kind of a nice coup how this happened. And you just recently had a very distinguished award given to you. Let's speak about that just a little bit, and then I've got two closing questions for you. But let everybody know about how awesome you are with this award you just received.
Well, I don't know how awesome I am, but I do know that some folks really stepped up and nominated me for some stuff, which is pretty cool. I won the 2002 award. It's for Bipolar Brave as the mental health and faith influencer. And so the Bipolar Brave 2022 award for mental health, faith and influencer basically says, not only am I a person that's out there advocating for folks with bipolar disorder and helping them find help and find hope and find connections, but also because I have bipolar disorder, I'm leading from a place of need as well as from a place of understanding. And so it's through the efforts of being out there every day and trying to change the conversation around social media and online and in any place that anybody will hold still long enough to listen. And so I was really honored to be recognized in that way. I still feel like I'm just doing what anybody else could be doing in the way that anybody else could be doing it. So it was a decent surprise, and I was honored and flattered to be awarded that.
Yes, and you're humble, as I would suspect you would, because it's a really big deal, everybody. It's a super big deal. Justin's just being very humble, which, you know, I wouldn't expect anything less from him. So I have two questions in closing, and the first one is, what has been your most recent epiphany moment?
My most recent epiphany moment, a paradigm shift for me, has been that God is amazing and that he takes the thing in your life that has caused you the absolute most pain, and he uses that thing to help heal other people. And in the process, he helps you come to peace with what you've experienced, because it makes all of the struggle and all the pain and all the bad experiences I've had in my life around bipolar disorder, it gives them a context of value. Almost makes them worthwhile, because in fact it does make them worthwhile, because I can see that those prepared me to be able to be in a place where if someone says, hey, I'm experiencing this, I can say I did too. And that's the easiest way of being able just to come alongside somebody. The idea of being a mental health champion matches up with that perfectly. We don't ask for anything more than what's described in the second chapter of Job, which is Job had lost everything in his whole life, his family, his kids had all died, his crops have all been burned, thieves stole everything he owned, his livestock was all gone, everything you could think to make it, so his livelihood, his family, everything was gone in the matter of 5 minutes. So he was broken in a very profound way. And so his friends heard of all the trouble he had had, and they came from afar to be there with him. And at the end of Job's second chapter, it says, they saw him from a distance and they could barely recognize him. So they sat down in the dirt next to him, and no one spoke a word for 7 days because his grief was so great. And so part of that epiphany that I'm talking that was there is the idea that I don't have to know anything or do anything or have special letters behind the end of my name or go through a certification process. All I got to do is be willing to sit in the dirt with people. Mm-hmm. And if you can sit in the dirt with people and just not say anything, just be there to be still and let God be God, then you can make a profound difference in someone's life. The other epiphany is that everything, and I mean everything that's psychological, is biological. Everything. Mm-hmm. So when you start thinking about mental health and mental health issues and mental wellness, it's not this ethereal in the cloud, non-tangible thing that it's hard to put your hands around and get a wrap on it. It's a biological issue in your brain. And if you had an issue with your pancreas making enough insulin so you could not be diabetic, or if you had an issue with your heart so it would beat properly so you wouldn't have high blood pressure or heart disease, we're okay with that being biological. And the medications that come alongside and the normalization that comes alongside and the taking the medication that comes alongside. Brain's just another organ. And the stuff we experience when we're going through even the hardest parts of our mental health challenges is universally a result of something that's either an injury to the brain and things like PTSD, or it's a chemical imbalance in the brain that this one place just doesn't make enough of this certain chemical. I like to describe mine as if you've ever tried to wash your car with a garden hose and you kink the garden hose to turn off the water so very a little dribbles out at the end. That's what it's like for me in my depressive states. And then when you open that thing up to start spraying it, and it comes off like super powerful. That's me in my manic phases. So it's too little or too much of the chemicals hitting the place at the same time, but it's never just a steady flow like some other people are fortunate enough to experience. So it's biological. That means it's totally, completely experiential for every person on the planet and definitely relatable. So those were the two real epiphanies that came through for me recently.
That's good. Okay, now I used to phrase this question different, and then by me asking you what you want your legacy to be, is that you're kind of shutting yourself down as to what other people could say your legacy is when you when you finally complete this mission on Earth. So I'm just going to rephrase it and ask you, what do you want to be remembered for? How do you want people to remember you?
Very simply put, I want people to say that he loved God and he loved other people with everything he had. Because I think that everything we talk about, everything we experience, whether it's in our own personal recoveries, it's the way that we reach out and advocate to the world, how we have our interpersonal relationships, how we speak things into the world that maybe are in a void that aren't being addressed. All of that can come from a place of pride, or it can come from a place of love. And I always want to come from a place of love. I want people to not be impressed with what I know. I want people to be reminded of how much I love them and how important they are to me. And I think if I can keep the reflection aspect of the love God gives me and reflect even a portion of it back onto anybody else, that's the way I'd like to be remembered. And if that is exclusively in this calling and mental health challenges, if that's the fact that I made one singular friend in this world that felt a little more like they belonged, that's enough.
That's a perfect answer. All right, everybody. So this has been Dustin Bailey. If you want to talk to him or book him for a show or whatever, you can reach him at crmhaz@gmail.com. This has been an amazing interview. And for Mental Health Awareness Month, I really couldn't have asked for a better dude to come on and explain a whole bunch of stuff that I would have just jumbled all up. So thank you, Dustin. It's been my honor and my pleasure to have you on Dancing with Bipolar. And we will definitely be chatting again soon. So have a wonderful rest of your afternoon. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Have a blessed day. And like I said, if you need something, let me know. That's what I do.
I shall. All right. Well, go give your babies and your wife a big hug for me. And thank you again so much.